A former ethics chief in the George W. Bush administration condemned President Trump's mishandling of calls to families of fallen soldiers and said the president lacks compassion because he dodged his own military service. Former chief White House ethics lawyer Richard Painter told CNN Wednesday that Trump's public references to White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's son, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2010, were, quote, atrocious. This does, however, open up an avenue of valuable conversation about empathy. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Michael Sledge is the author of Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. He is a freelance journalist who has studied sociology and psychology of the behavior of military personnel. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into this conversation about empathy, we have these images in our head when we hear the words fallen soldier, perhaps the picture of the tarmac at Dover Air Force Base, a flag-draped coffin coming home. Perhaps it's a military funeral with taps and a grieving widow accepting a folded flag. And you say in your book, we know vaguely how the wounded are looked after, but next to nothing about what happens after the accounts in military history books end. And you ask this really haunting question in your book, who, if anybody, looks after the dead? And how do we talk about fallen soldiers? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a subject that a lot of people don't want to think about, but it's one that obviously very many people do put a lot of time and attention and care into. It was in the early 2000s when I heard a story about the recovery of remains in the Korean War. And I open up my book, Soldier Dead, with that story. And it was a strong enough story that it practically brought me to my knees. And then I started asking around to my friends. I said, you know, we see all these war films with soldiers training, with soldiers fighting, with soldiers coming home. And here and there we'll catch a scene where there's the graves or they're carrying the bodies back. And I said, but what really happens? And, you know, all my friends started kind of scratching their heads saying, well, you know, I never really thought about it. I don't really know. And it's a topic that you have to approach with, you know, a great deal of care and compassion and empathy, because you're talking about people who have lost their husband, they've lost their son, they've lost their father, they've lost their brothers, and now they've, you know, lost their mothers, sisters. And so I started doing the research, and it took a couple of years of research. I've traveled all over the world, and I found out that there is this huge mechanism that is very respectful, very reverent for the most part, but which had a really terrible job to do. And that's basically to find the dead, to identify them, and then to bring them back, all in a manner which gives due regard and due respect to those who died and the loved ones left behind.
You found in writing your book that despite outreach programs by the military, families are seldom asked what works best for them. You say that the military still seems intent on deciding just what the next of kin need rather than instituting a form of feedback for their responses. What about how politicians like presidents console grieving families? Are they approaching it the right way?
Well, you use the word they, presidents in plural. Each president has his or her own, his own method of handling. So it's perfectly clear to me that President Trump used a very poor choice of words when speaking to the widow of Sergeant Alagar. Now, to a true state of mind, you know, we can only guess. But if there's one thing that my extensive research has taught me, okay, is that the communications and actions with regard to those who died in service of their country can be easily misinterpreted. And those at the high levels of our government and military need to be acutely aware that the truth of the matter is that impressions are reality and that you rarely get a second chance to correct.
You rarely get a second chance to correct. So those words can speak volumes.
Yes. many presidents in the past made their initial communication, well, back before our current time period, there were so many dead that, of course, the president couldn't have called them off. You know, we lost 300,000 in World War II alone, and 50,000 in Korea, 50,000 in Vietnam, and so the president did not get involved personally with the phone calls, although there were exceptions at the time when the Secretary of War would reach out and make personal communication. However, now, ever since the Gulf War, we've seen that the presidents have taken a larger role in communication. A compassionate but safe way to do it is with telegram or letter at first. Later, then to follow back up with a meeting or a phone call, President Bush has done, President Obama has done. It's tough because sometimes the person carrying the news or trying to carry condolences is in a no-win situation. And because obviously it's a time of extreme emotional turmoil. So great care, caution, and planning should be used.
Chief of Staff John Kelly's son died in 2010 in battle, and he says he advised the president not to call loved ones of fallen soldiers, and he spoke publicly yesterday about this. Let's listen.
If you elect to call a family like this, it is about the most difficult thing you could imagine. There's no perfect way to make that phone call.
That was an emotional speech from Kelly, and he says that phone call, even from the president, cannot help grieving families. Is that true?
Well, I wouldn't say that it can't help. I would say, like my earlier statement was, is that it can easily be misinterpreted. It's easy to say the wrong thing. We know how hard that is in a case like that, and you're speaking off the cuff. And some people don't speak off the cuff very well. So, I think it's pretty clear like that, in cases like that. I mean, really, the words there are just terrible because everyone knows that when you go to sign up that you run the risk of not coming back alive. And that's an understood. That's a given. It's just poor personal communication. But like I said, as to the president's intentions, we can only guess. And he didn't have to make the phone call at all. He could have just followed tradition and sent a letter at first and then waited. So it's just extremely difficult in this situation. Who wants to have that job?
Mike Sledge is with us. He is the author of Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you the family member of a fallen soldier? How would you like to have them honored? What is your reaction to President Trump's handling of the four soldiers who were slain in Niger? How do you think presidents and our country should honor our fallen soldiers? Join in this conversation about empathy at 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael, I'm wondering then if words, word choice can be so difficult in this very difficult time, and the family members are going through what circumstance they or frame of mind they're in, we don't know. Why do presidents then choose to lift the phone and dial the number and try to talk to a grieving family member?
You asked the question, why would they make that phone call?
Yeah.
The president is the chief commander in chief. Basically, President Truman said the buck stops here. So one would imagine and hope that the president making a phone call in this manner would have the care and concern of the family first and foremost in mind, and would be basically trying to, number one, console the family, but also to give them something to look forward to, and by recognizing that this soldier had given his or her life, for the country. So one would think that they're trying to both, you know, extend a little bit of salve for terrible wounds, and at the same time, you know, say, hold your chins up high because he or she died doing what they had, you know, had signed up for, which was to protect the country.
Inadvertently or not, President Trump has picked a political fight over what presidents have performed better in honoring the war dead and their families. The subject arose because nearly 2 weeks passed before the president called the families of four U.S. soldiers who were killed in Niger. You can join this conversation, 800-642-1234. Mike Sledge is with us. He is the author of Fallen Soldier, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. We'll be back after this news update. President Bush pushed back harder on Wednesday against a congresswoman's account of his phone call to the widow of a slain soldier. Trump insists he didn't tell a fallen soldier's widow that he knew what he was signing up for before he was killed in Niger.
Didn't say what that congresswoman said. Didn't say it at all. She knows it, and she now is not saying it. I did not say what she said, and I'd like her to make the statement again because I did not say what she said. I had a very nice conversation with the woman, with the wife, who is sounded like a lovely woman.
We're discussing presidential empathy this hour with Mike Sledge. He's the author of the book Fallen Soldier, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the president's handling of the four soldiers who were slain in Niger? How do you think presidents and our country as a whole should honor our fallen soldiers? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike Sledge, before we get to some calls here, I want to get your reaction to what the president said there in denying this back and forth between the congresswoman.
Well, if it had been me, I would not have issued a denial. Instead, I would have turned the subject right back to what's really important, which is the fact that a young man now is gone from this country. We have a grieving family. If it had been me, I would have simply said, I'm sorry that there's misinterpretation out there. Let's focus back and let's give, hope. Let's give support. Let's give some solace to the family. I would have not have interjected, the me, the my. I didn't say this. I would have, people are going to have their impressions. I would just go back and be empathetic, be compassionate, not make it about what I said or didn't say, but would go back to the subject, which is the grieving widow.
Let's take a call now. Rana in Rice Lake. Hi, Rana.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to add that I don't think the commander-in-chief has an option in contacting fallen military members' families. My husband was a Black Hawk pilot in Iraq, flew many, many missions for many, many different reasons. One of the things he is still unable to talk about would be his hero missions, where he flew deceased soldiers' bodies from point A to point B, fully knowing that as a Black Hawk pilot, this would be potentially one of his obligations that he would do to the fullest of anything he possibly had. He gave it his all. I don't think the commander-in-chief should be held to any less account. If we have military people who are doing these services and providing the best care that they can for the fallen, I think the commander-in-chief, the head of our military, should fall under the same guidelines.
Mike Sledge.
Well, first, let me thank you for your husband, which is duty to the country like that. And I know it's a very tough job of transporting the remains of the fallen like that. As a matter of fact, the post-traumatic stress disorder among those who transport, handle, care, prepare the remains back here at the States. It's just as high, if not higher, than actual combat troops. There's a lot going on with that, and fortunately, the military branches are working a great deal to help these service members like this. The other thing about it, not talking about it, this, of course, is not at all uncommon. We pretty much, for the most part, all know that the World War II soldiers came back, and they shut up. They didn't talk about it. There were a few notable books that were done at the time, but then much stuff that came later. I had conversation after conversation where the elderly men now basically just broke down and cried because they finally had someone they could talk to about this. Now, I ask you the question is, should the president himself be held to the standards that the regular military members have? The answer, of course, is absolutely. And that's going to become a very, the best way I know how to say this is a very personalized, very individual approach. Quite frankly, some people are going to do a better job of it than others. I think President Trump not only mishandled the initial communication, I think his follow-up has basically just made the situation worse. Again, if it had been me, I would have said whatever was interpreted, it could be that I didn't use the right word, but let's go back and let's all make this about giving the widow the support that she needs at this point in time. So I think he failed in that manner. Again, as to his intentions, one can only guess like that. But absolutely, the president should be aware of and, try to rise to a higher standard. Those, like you said by your caller, those that are followed in the field. I can tell you, I was in Iraq, in Baghdad, Iraq, 2003, when they were bringing remains in, and I had the right to pick my camera up and take pictures of the, of course, they were in their transfer cases or whatever. I had that right to do so, but I could not do that. I could not bring myself to do that because the respect that was being shown by all the soldiers was just so immense, and it was so heartbreaking that I just stood there in quiet and reverence and did not exercise the right to do so because I thought it would have been disrespectful.
Rana, thank you so much for your call and your eloquence. Let's go to Bob in Wauwatosa. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. First, I'd like to preface this by saying that the men and women that serve in the United States Armed Forces are doing a tremendous value to the country, and those that fall in the service should be remembered. And I would suggest everyone go out to a national cemetery or just a regular cemetery. It doesn't have to be a Memorial Day, and just look around and think. But as to this instant question, and when you started this program, you quoted someone from an ethics office who claimed that President Trump had no empathy. I'm a retired attorney. You cannot judge anyone whether they have empathy or not. And anyone that claims to be an ethicist that has that is simply barking down a psychological rat hole. Who knows what people think? We can't get inside their heads. We can't judge their overall person. You can judge their actions. You can judge their words. Should President Trump have called the person? I don't think you should. I come, as I indicated before to your screener, I come from a family that my father served in three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He saw hundreds of his comrades called. He had to write the letters. I don't think the president ever called, or any president could have called. Who knows what went on in the actual conversation? I understand it's recorded, but I highly doubt that President Trump would have called someone, or anyone would have called someone, for the purpose of disrespecting a soldier.
And Bob, we're going to leave it there and let Mike answer. How is it hard to judge where someone is coming from with empathy? Mike Sledge?
Yes, it is. This is my comment I've made a couple of times. We can't look inside for Trump's mind. I think we can pretty much agree that the word choice was poor. I think we can pretty much agree that some of his follow-up actions left a lot to be desired. But as far as what he really meant, as your caller said, that's very difficult to do. I think your caller also had a great idea. This would be a good time for everyone to have their own moment of silence and go out to a military cemetery and pay their own thanks and regards right here. And let's hope that, you know, from this point forward, everyone is going to think about this a little bit harder before we just, you know, pick up the phone, good intentions aside, and, you know, let's go back to these people died for us. And I think if we all circle back to that, then we'll all be in a better place going forward.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
That was Michael Sledge, author of Fallen Soldier, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. Now let's bring in Pastor Eric Wester. He's assistant to the presiding bishop and director of federal chaplaincies for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. He's based in Washington, D.C. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleased to join you.
Well, let's get your initial reaction in these recent days where we've had this bigger discussion about empathy and what our politicians do to reach out to grieving family members.
Well, I think, you know, politicians are in an interesting public role, and the conversation as it's unfolded, I think, has really only followed the trajectory of the polarizing talk. So in a way, I'm a little discouraged that what is part of a reality of military life sometimes becomes harder to see when there's so much light and smoke and attention focused on the political life.
What are some ways as chaplains that chaplains, approach empathy in these times when a soldier has died in the field?
Well, you know, that's really at the heart of chaplaincy ministry in the military and in the Department of Veterans Affairs in hospitals as well. I think the approach is grounded in humility and awe. Awe at the willingness of people to serve the nation and to serve people that they may not even know. I mean, they represent all of us as a nation, and I think there's genuine regard for that. And I think for chaplains, the spirit of humility. Chaplains go on almost every casualty notification call. I've done many of these in the years I served in uniform, and currently support about 150 Lutheran pastors right now who are serving in uniform. So the themes of humility and awe are central to this. And for people in grief, the signs and symbols of faith are really quite powerful, whether it's reading or reciting the 23rd Psalm, saying the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, using the language of familiar hymns, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, Amazing Grace. These kind of, in some ways, predictable parts of religious expression, you know, take on a whole nother depth when you're sitting in the living room with a grieving family.
And then there are the words. Some people say the president is right. The soldier knows they sign up for a job that is incredibly dangerous. Some people say that that's not the proper thing to say to a grieving family member. So what is the right language? What do you say?
Well, there's a lot of experience with this, Katie. In fact, coming at it from the vantage point of the military, these encounters are carefully prepared and arranged. I mean, I'm thinking of an experience that I saw recounted a few years ago by a young guy named Captain Franklin Alexander, who was a notification officer in the Oklahoma Army National Guard. He and Chaplain Jeremy Dunn went to the home of this 20, I want to say she's about 27, 28-year-old mother of two or three children. Her husband was activated with the Guard unit. And Captain Alexander made a point of saying, you know, when he comes to that door, he carries with him a tremendous sense of responsibility for the Secretary of the Army, for the nation, and delivers words that he memorizes carefully, syllable by syllable, and names the name of the fallen soldier, and then leans on the chaplain to offer a word of consolation. So from the military point of view, that's the beginning of a whole series of rituals. I'm in Washington. Last week I was at Arlington Cemetery. Chaplains there typically do 5 funerals a day, 4.5 days a week. So on a light day, they do 2 or 3. And that process is grounded in a tremendous sense of gratitude and respect for those who serve. And, you know, when it comes to the words, they really matter. I think over the long haul, the words that are nested in a relationship matter a lot more. I think it's less what is said, but who says it and how it's said. So you mentioned tone as we started. I mean, this is a time for, in the intimacy of a family encounter, for a tremendous sense of humility and respect. You know, a brief call from a public figure may be very meaningful or memorable for some individuals or families. I think over the long haul, it's the near family, the extended family, the immediate community. And
that makes the greatest impression.
Yep. And they're vital for the continuing consolation that's needed. I mean, I'm thinking of one of our Lutheran pastors who serves in a congregation, who's a Marine Corps Reserve veteran. His unit was mobilized. They went to Iraq, dealt with very heavy combat. For 6 years, that unit reconvened on the weekend of the Marine Corps Marathon, which, by the way, is this weekend here in D.C. Mm. That unit reconvened because 6 years later they were processing the impact of these casualties and their shared life together in uniform. So, you know, sometimes it's an American Legion Hall or a VFW, which, you know, those are on the edge of a lot of communities around the country. But there's an awful lot of compassion and caring that goes on in those conversations.
President Trump seemed to call out his predecessors this week with a casual mention that they did not always call the families of fallen service members. And that drew fierce rebukes from former presidential aides. But it opened up this larger conversation about how presidents and political office holders, how they interact with families of fallen servicemen and women. And we've been thinking about that here on The Morning Show. Pastor Eric Wester stays with us. He's assistant to the presiding bishop and director of federal chaplaincies of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. His ministry supports 230 chaplains and chaplain candidates in the military, Veterans Administration, and federal prisons. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. How do you think we should honor fallen soldiers? What should you say in this time? What should and shouldn't you do? What is the protocol? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this news. Let's face it, some people are just not as good with words at sensitive times. Sometimes words come out in the wrong way, and presidents are expected to have a high level of empathy. We're talking about how presidents and politicians console grieving families when a soldier has been killed this hour. Pastor Eric Wester stays with us. He's director of federal chaplaincies for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Chaplain Wester completed 32 years in the Army chaplaincy, ending as the Senior Military Fellow at National Defense University in Washington, D.C. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you the family member of a fallen soldier? How would you like them to be honored? What sticks out in your mind at that time of grief? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go right to Elaine in Appleton. Hi, Elaine.
Hello. I have a very interesting story. My cousin was killed in Korea 60 years ago, and about 2 years ago, they brought his body back. A farmer in North Korea was digging, and he found the bones, and they contacted the governments, and then they came and picked him up and took him to Hawaii lab, and they tested every bone in his body, what was left of him, for DNA. And before that, they had contacted our family, the government had, and asked for DNA samples. So they had my blood on file, and so our DNA matched up perfectly. But they tested every one of his bones before they sent him back. And there was a soldier from Green Bay and one from Kentucky came and talked to the family, and it was like he had just died. They were so kind and caring, and the media got involved because it was such a spectacular story. And they were very, the veterans groups and everyone was so kind and caring about how they did things and asked questions and things like that. And it was like he died yesterday. It was the, you know, I was so impressed at how nice people were to everyone after all these years. And it meant a lot to us that they still honored his service and everything after 60 years.
Chaplain Wester, I want to get your reaction to what Elaine is saying. There seemed to be so much ritual and also a great support system in the protocol.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Katie. And Elaine, condolences on your loss even after all these years, but gratitude for the military service and sacrifice of your cousin. I mean, in a way, you encapsulate what is part of a national and family story about the real impact of the cost of wartime service. So I salute your fallen cousin and am proud to be in any way associated with his service to our nation. Thanks also for mentioning those who came to provide the official notification. You know, there's a kind of a timelessness when it comes to how members of the military identify in the ranks. You know, there's a phrase that flows out of the graduate process from West Point, the long gray line. I mean, people in uniform have a sense they're marching during the season of their service, but there's been plenty who have gone before us and still others to come. And I think given the scale of grief and death that's associated with the brokenness of war, there have been a lot of rites and rituals, everything from the notification that Elaine mentioned, you know, to the presentation of the flag and the playing of taps at the graveside. There's plenty in between. And, you know, Veterans Day is another opportunity every year to acknowledge this, whether or not you're a veteran yourself.
Elaine, thank you so much for calling in with your story. And thanks. Rick in Hartford. Go ahead, Rick.
Good morning to your guests. I just wanted to say a couple of things. One, I'm a combat vet.
Yep.
Two, I have a son that will be serving in harm's way.
Yes.
Very quickly. This whole thing gets me choked up. I'm going to say something that needs to be said. And I think it's disgusting that woman, congressman, and the way she is trying to gain political advantage over our president. I think it was completely misconstrued. I think if you would have heard her recording and the way she was gleeful on being treated as a rock star as she's hovering over this woman who is receiving the news, it to me is disgusting. First point needs to be said. Completely taken off. Second point, what the president said and how it was said. I have been around friends. I lost my squad leader in Desert Storm. This is way, way beyond the pale. Third point, and I'll leave you with this. This is why you don't kneel during the national anthem. Thank you.
Chaplain Wester, and he brings up, several points there. One is which the conversation has very much strayed from the actual fallen soldier.
Well, you're exactly right, Katie. And frankly, in my first couple of sentences, I tried to make the point that, you know, there's a big difference between the polarizing talk that has surfaced around the interaction between President Trump and the family of one of our fallen soldiers, and I think a much larger set of issues. Rick mentioned a couple of those, but I mean, as a nation, we are in the longest lasting period of wartime activity in the history of the country, and yet, except for occasional, dramatic news reports of something that happens, there's an awful lot of invisible service and sacrifice that's almost invisible to the public. And I don't want to pile on much, but when I go to sporting events, I find the ritual of, waving our caps during, a break in the sports action, in a way, minimizes the true nature of what is happening in real lives, those who are serving, and the fact that they're serving on behalf of our country. In a way, with an all-volunteer force, and that brings up another side of this, but, I mean, we've kind of, in essence, outsourced military service to those who are willing to serve. And I think it's had a kind of a distancing effect on the connections between those in uniform and the civilian community.
Chaplain Eric Wester, I'm wondering how you persevere. Do you experience a lot of emotional distress from being a chaplain and the other chaplains that you support? Because doing that many funerals and approaching that many grieving families.
Well, like Rick said, it's the emotions and feeling choked up are never too far beneath the surface. The continuity for me in terms of military service precedes 9/11, and Rick mentioned Desert Storm. I was in uniform then. I mean, I was at the Pentagon on 9/11, and some of the most compelling parts of my experience in ministry as a chaplain were outside the walls of the Pentagon and serving as a pastoral resource to a Puerto Rican Army National Guard unit that was on active duty for 18 months, sorting through the personal effects of those that were killed in the attack on 9/11 at the Pentagon. These are invisible stories to a large degree, and to focus on the dynamics around the president and this one event, I hope can open us up to recognizing a much wider reality in our culture about war, the costs of war, the hidden costs of war.
We have time for just one more call here. Andrew, who is driving through Wisconsin. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yes, thank you for having me on here. I'd like to start off by thanking Chaps for what he and all the other chaplains do. They go way beyond just the spiritual side. I've been helped by chaplains with things that have nothing to do with religion. You can kind of see that by the way he talks about how he goes out to do death notification and things of that nature. There is no real way to say how much those chaplains help the military and their families. It's just fantastic. Another thing that I served in the Marine Corps for a time, and he was fortunate enough to actually work as part of a presidential service unit. And so I got a chance to kind of see the presidency and some of the people that work under them a lot closer. Some of my friends that are still in actually are serving President Trump right now. And from what I've been told, the stories that they share with me, he definitely cares about the service members. And that's something that I hope people don't lose, just by hearing the media. From the people that are actually there serving him, standing next to him.
I'm going to let Chaplain Wester, because we are short on time, respond here as we wrap up.
Semper Fi, Andrew. Thanks for your comments. And, I observed both President Bush and President Obama doing some direct interactions with family members. And I agree that there's something that's remarkably powerful about having the commander-in-chief engage in those ways. And I think of an occasion with President Bush meeting with family members in a small group down at Fort Jackson. It got absolutely no publicity or media attention, and that's the way he wanted it. Images of President Obama at Dover receiving the dignified transfer of remains of those killed in action. A rare photograph, but no publicity, no media attention. So there's an irony that somehow this has become such a media drama, and unfortunately I think it got stoked by somehow encapsulating all this in a sense of, well, who's the more caring among our commanders-in-chief? And I've seen from the inside it matters to do that in a way that's very humble and respectful.
Well, Pastor Eric Wester, thanks for being with us.
I was honored to be here. Thanks, Katie. It's an important conversation about the impacts of wartime experience in our country.
That was Pastor Eric Wester, Director of Federal Chaplaincies for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, based in Washington. Earlier this hour, we spoke with Mike Sledge, author of Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. The Morning Show is produced by Nyjah Ellison and Keely Beltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Technical direction this hour from Michelle Good. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.